Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
Hi, welcome to the Football Writers Podcast. My name's Mike Calvin. I'm joined by Dom Fifield of The Guardian and by Daniel Storey, the author and columnist. And then there were none. Liverpool are not invincible. Manchester City are still in arrears. Defining match between them or just another drama? Can City make up a 4-point gap or will Liverpool bounce back? Whatever the answers, we're in for the perfect title race. Fine margins until the end of the season. It's a tough one, isn't it?
Yeah, and it was an intriguing game. It was fine margins at the Etihad Stadium with the ball just about staying out, the 1.12 centimetres, wasn't it, Daft? Something like that. Liverpool hitting the post, City hitting the post and it going in. But we'd expected that because they are the two outstanding teams in the division. I know Spurs are up there and still got a chance, but those are the two stellar teams. And it has provided us with a dramatic title race now. I think, looking back, I think City were 14 points clear at the same time last year. And if you go back to the year before, Chelsea were 7 points clear as well. So we've actually got two teams, possibly three, going head-to-head, giving it a go. And one team slips up, it'll fuel the ambitions of the other for the remainder of the campaign. It's going to be intriguing, it'll be tight, and it'll be exciting.
And once the FA Cup's out of the way, I suppose Liverpool will be judged by how they bounce back from that defeat, albeit a narrow one. In that context, how important is the next game at Brighton?
It's huge. I mean, Jurgen Klopp will tell his side that was only 3 points, that was only one game. And he'll also tell them, I think, that they kind of earned the right to lose against Manchester City and still, as they are still, be odds on title favourites. So, yeah, he will plead that there is no drama, that was a 90 minutes of pure theatre. But that aside, they have to go back to doing exactly what they have been doing all season. And quite frankly, if they play as they did, albeit in defeat against Manchester City, against 14 or 15 other Premier League teams, they'll beat those 14 or 15 Premier League teams, and that's all they need to do. It is entirely still in their own hands. But yeah, we judge these games by how teams respond to them, because we know that exactly with City, they lose to Crystal Palace at home, nobody saw that coming, and then it kind of spirals into a, what's happening? Have we lost our aura? And that can very easily happen if you're not careful.
I suppose in the modern world in which we live, both media-wise and in football society, there's got to be a scapegoat somewhere. And I suppose a lot of the Liverpool fans are blaming Lovren for his performance at the Etihad. Are we in a situation where someone like Joe Gomez becomes a better player when he's not actually in the team because of the injury?
Well, I think we all know that Joe Gomez is outstanding. I mean, he's a big loss to Liverpool when he's been out injured. He was a fantastic player for England in the autumn internationals as well, and a key player for the future of the national team. So I don't think that's revelatory. Lovren. Well, he said he was the one that was saying that Liverpool could go invincible.
He doesn't help himself.
He really doesn't. I mean, as journalists, we should be. We should be welcoming such outlandish statements, as indeed he said in the summer when he said he was a world-class defender. But I just thought the intensity of that game was something else. I thought City were brilliant at stopping Liverpool from playing There was that one moment where the front three in the first half combined for Liverpool, and they in the old style, where they all clicked, and that's when Mane hit the post and the ball almost went in off the rebound. But other than that, if you look at Fernandinho, if you look at Kompany and Stones at centre-half, you know, Laporte doing a passable job at left back, and that's an area where City have been so weak recently without Mondi. And teams have exposed them, but they managed to contain Liverpool even on that flank. And it was a reminder that City aren't just all about dazzling and, you know, the pizzazz. They can actually be a hard, difficult team to break down as well. And there was only really a couple of moments in that match where Liverpool looked their old selves.
Mm. You're at the game, Dan, for the iPaper. By the way, how on earth did you get Sherlock Holmes in your intro? You can tell us later. Give us an idea and a flavour of that atmosphere. And does that, you know, you've seen a lot of City recently. Was that a change to normal business, if you like?
Yeah, I think it was a change. It was startling to me how early before the game fans arrived. I know with an 8 o'clock kickoff and, you know, a ground half an hour walk from the town centre, it kind of makes sense to hang around and come to the ground early. But it did feel different. It did feel a slightly more special atmosphere perhaps than we're used to. And it does also feel like Manchester City and Liverpool is this kind of new Premier League rivalry, maybe the new big Premier League rivalry, purely because of, you know, not rivalry based necessarily on history, but purely on you know, on the talent of the two teams. So yes, it did feel different, and it didn't feel different because quite often in these examples, managers ask for the fans to be bigger, or the club demands that fans.
Well, the 12th man.
Exactly,
routine,
that kind of cliche. But actually, there was none of that before the game. The game spoke for itself. The hype spoke for itself, and the game spoke for itself as well. So often these games are letdowns, but. Mm. But that, you know, that didn't happen. It did match up to everything that we thought it could be. But yeah, I think City fans realised that this was a win or bust scenario. Effectively, the first half an hour was quite strange in that City knew they couldn't concede first. But it was almost as if that Mane shot off the post made him realise we can't be passive here. We have to impress ourselves upon the game, and if we do that, we can win it.
Mm. In terms of rivalries, is this just going to be a rivalry for the ages, or is it something that we might be diverted by for a couple of years?
I'd be interested to see whether the rivalry is sustained, you know, if Pep and Klopp aren't at their respective clubs. I mean, that is a rivalry that was forged in Germany and has been brought to the Premier League and imposed on the Premier League. They are the two, you know, stellar teams, as we said earlier. But, you know, yeah, it fades in and out, doesn't it? So we'll see. I mean, it wasn't long ago that we were talking about Brendan Rodgers and, I don't know, Pellegrini possibly being a rivalry when Liverpool and City had Chelsea had that three-way tussle at the top of the table. But there's something about this, the way that both of these clubs have been long-term planning, and they've brought the, I mean, Pep obviously slightly sooner with the, not least with the resources that they spent last summer in 2017 to have that incredible season last year. And everything about the progress that Klopp has made at Liverpool to try and eat into that lead has been wonderfully impressive so far. So it does have, you know, potentially it could sustain itself for a while longer, but let's just see what happens when those managers depart.
Also, it's Liverpool have beautifully filled that Manchester United void as well for City, haven't they? Because I think if Manchester United were, let's say, in Spurs' position in third or pushing for second and first, I think the Manchester City and Liverpool, I think I honestly feel like it would feel like more of a three-horse race if it was Manchester United rather than Tottenham, simply because of the rivalries between the three clubs. Whereas, yeah, Liverpool have kind of perfectly filled that Manchester United void.
Mm. Do you think English football needs a successful Liverpool club simply because of what it represents, that the tradition of it and the sheer vibrancy of the atmosphere that their fans can create?
As a neutral, yes. Yeah. You know, I'm not a supporter of a Premier League club, and the Premier League is more exciting when it has a good Liverpool team in it. Not least because there has always been in the last 10 years that faint sense that they might implode as well as, you know, explode positively. They might implode upon themselves, and for that implosion to be spectacular, they need to get into a position where they can win things and fail to do so. It's, you know, the cliche of Spursy is exactly the same. It doesn't work unless they get themselves in a position to win those trophies. But yeah, absolutely. I think I would rather have four or five teams in a Premier League title race, but that seems entirely unsustainable. It feels great to have potentially three still in kind of early to mid-January.
In terms of lessons from you can draw from that one defeat of the season so far, balance in the midfield three, maybe?
Yeah, possibly went a bit cautious. I think Fabinho's obviously come on leaps and bounds of late, and possibly he might look at the back at that and wonder whether he could have started with him. I mean, he did make a big impact when he came on. That he could see the whole tempo of the Liverpool team and their passing, you know, raised when Fabinho was introduced. But it was so tight. He's not going to look at that and think, oh, I've got my tactics completely wrong here. If the ball had been slightly to the right and Mane's shot goes in, or, you know, John Stones doesn't stretch that to clear the ball off the line seconds later, then that's a completely different scenario. I think he'll be really level-headed about the nature of the defeat, and he'll look at the chance to go to Brighton, which isn't an easy fixture, and Brighton don't lose many home games. Mm. But Liverpool have excelled at the Amex in the recent past. He'll look at that as an opportunity just to restore some momentum. You know, this time last year when City lost their first league game of the season at Liverpool, they went on another unbeaten run, which was only ended when they lost the derby, when, you know, the title was as good as there anyway. That's Liverpool's next task. They've got to get back on the bike and make sure that they are now unbeaten for, let's say, 8-10 more matches. And if they survey the scene then, they could have a healthy lead at the top.
Mm. When you judge players, you look at how they perform in the biggest matches. Aguero, for instance, he was really, he just adapted to the pace of that game and the intensity of it. And you know, what about Fernandinho? That was an 11 out of 10 performance, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. He's, I think we probably overlooked even last season just how important he is as that kind of security blanket to Manchester City's defence, especially at a time when it's not at the top of its game itself. You know, they haven't kept a clean sheet. I think since, you know, what was it West Ham, I think?
A long time ago.
Yeah, a long time ago. 12 or 13 games, I think. So it's not at its best, and Fernandinho manages to protect that almost by himself. He did have a lot of help from Bernardo Silva last night. I thought he was astonishing, his energy levels and his pressing higher up the pitch, and that makes things easier for Fernandinho. But yeah, I think he's probably Manchester City's most important player, because there's no one else that replaces exactly what he does. And that's why Guardiola wanted a defensive midfielder last summer. That's why he was so keen on Jorginho and so keen on Fred, because, you know, Fernandinho's 33 years old. He played a World Cup. He had a long season last season. He's already had one little injury. And I think, you know, I honestly believe, no hyperbole to say, that if he gets injured, Liverpool will win the title. I honestly think it's that simple.
It's a bit strange, though, to think that City and Pep Guardiola saw Jorginho as a potential replacement for Fernandinho, because Fernandinho's got energy and he's a dynamic defensive midfielder, whereas Jorginho just seems quite passive and it's all about simple passing. And I know we haven't seen the best of him yet, because we haven't seen a proper Maurizio Sarri team at Chelsea yet, but it doesn't seem a like for like. And Fred, likewise. Yeah. I mean, maybe there's potential there, but you're right. When Fernandinho doesn't play, I mean, you know, they could get away with it in the past, but the Palace result, in many ways, showed that if you don't have that defensive midfielder who to set a tempo and set the tone in the middle of the park, even a team like Palace can overrun you, and you're Manchester City. But you're right, Bernardo Silva was magnificent, but also Raheem Sterling was sensational again, and almost on the quiet. I know people concentrate on Sane scoring the winning goal, but Sterling's runs from deep and possession of the ball and just the cuteness of his passing when to release to his fellow forwards was absolutely fantastic. Brilliant player.
Mm. Yeah, you're back at the Etihad for the League Cup semi-final, which, with the greatest win in the world, is going to be a shoe-in against Burton. Let's pay due tribute to a club like Burton ended up in a last four like that. But also put it in the context of City's season. Is the League Cup the one they can afford to give away?
Yeah, it is, although having reached the semi-final stage and heavy favourites to get to the final, Guardiola will, I presume, play a heavily weakened team in both legs against Burton, certainly presuming that they get half the job done in the first leg. And he will... I honestly think after that Liverpool victory, he will tell his team, we need to win every game we play now. Take aside the Champions League, because that at some point could become their priority if they do drop off in the Premier League. But I think he will tell them, we've shown we are good enough to beat the form team in the country. Mm. And the form team in the country who didn't... Liverpool didn't bottle it. They didn't not turn up. Manchester City beat them fair and square. Mm. And he will say, if we can beat them, we can beat any team in any competition. And he's right to.
Mm. Busy times for Tottenham. And I suppose we do... You know, they have been almost overlooked in all this debate that we've... Well, we've done the same thing, haven't we? A really busy week ahead. You know, once the FA Cup's out of the way, they've got the League Cup semi-final against Chelsea and then Manchester United, which is going to be the Pochettino show, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. I mean, I suppose the fact that Ole Gunnar Solskjaer started so well, albeit against substandard opposition, has taken a bit of the focus away from Pochettino and his future. I'm still not convinced that he'd go there, to be honest. I suspect there may be bigger overtures that he finds harder to turn down from Spain when he does end up leaving Tottenham Hotspur.
But Real Madrid.
Yeah, I think so. I think then it becomes a choice as to whether he goes to a club that fire managers after one or two seasons, or whether he can go to Old Trafford and then build a maybe a long term project. But then there's also the Spurs project that is ongoing, and the dynamics of that change when they're in the redeveloped White Hart Lane, and he may look at that and think the potential is there to take them to the next level. And you know, the next level is winning Premier League titles at Spurs. He's done so well already. It is a difficult few days for them. The focus in the Chelsea game, unfortunately, will be a lot on the sports supporters and what happens in the stands as a result of, you know, recent events at Chelsea. So, you know, hoping that people take their sensible heads to that match and it isn't sort of ruined for the wrong, you know, by repeats of the anti-Semitic chanting that we've heard on occasion of late. But that's a big test. It's a big test for Spurs against the Chelsea team who actually are struggling at the moment. So it's an opportunity for Tottenham as well.
Mm, what do you make of Spurs, Daniel? You know, I was amazed, to be perfectly honest, about that. You know, the way that they succumbed to Wolves, and they seem to have got back into their stride pretty quickly. How good can they be?
I think on their day, they are as good as anyone, which sounds like a cliche, but it's absolutely true. In a one-off contest, I think they can dominate any team if it clicks. I think in the context of a title race and even top four race, it's very hard for us to kind of take a step back and appreciate the bigger picture of how far clubs have come. Because if they achieve their goals in that particular season, we call it a success. And if they don't achieve those goals, we call it a failure, which is, in the case of Tottenham, is an absolute nonsense. Because if you look at quite how far Pochettino has taken that club with comparatively scant resources, it's the standout job in the top half of the Premier League over the last 5 years. It really is. His development of players such as Harry Kane, in terms of his all-round play, of Dele Alli, of Christian Eriksen, and then bringing on players that maybe weren't quite at that stellar level, is unsurpassed. I honestly believe that. But the reality is for him is that he will be judged against Manchester City and against Liverpool, however unfair that seems, because that's how far they're punching above their weight. And the reality is, if they finish third this season, don't win the FA Cup, don't win the League Cup, and go out in the Champions League quarterfinals, people will say Pochettino's failed, which is absurd. Really. Mm.
So in that context, Dom, is this a big January for Daniel Levy as well?
I just don't see them doing any major business in January. it's just not in their nature. And yeah, towards the end of the month, when you know the half of that team realised that they've were reminded that they've been playing in a World Cup semi-final, stroke final, stroke third, fourth place playoff, and they haven't stopped since, there will be some weary legs again and weary minds, possibly more to the point. But I don't. It's the same problem. Are they bringing players in January? They've got to be able to get walk straight into that first team. And A, those players may not are unlikely to be available in January because Tottenham's first team are at such a high level now. And B, they'll cost an absolute arm and a leg at mid-season. So I'd be surprised if anything major incoming happens with Spurs. And hopefully Daniel Levy can convince Maurizio Pochettino that, OK, look, we're making progress on the stadium. We'll be there soon. We'll be there soon. And then in the summer, the game changes and you'll have more scope to operate in that market. Pochettino may look at it and not want to disrupt things as well, of course. He had the say in the transfer policy in the summer. It wasn't just Daniel Levy making all these decisions. If Pochettino had really agitated, I'm sure he could have forced even Daniel Levy's hand into entering that market. But maybe the people weren't out there that he wanted. Maybe they'd become available in the summer.
Mm. Yeah, different strokes, different folks. If you look at Chelsea, different business model. Mm-hmm. You look at the signing of Pulisic, coming in for $58 million, going straight back to Dortmund. Possibility that would trigger Hudson-Odoi going to Bayern. They're talking about $30 million. Chelsea want $40 million. Is that a great business model, or is it a sign that everything is wrong with English football at a certain level?
I'm not sure if those two things need to be mutually exclusive. I think it probably is a pretty good business model for Chelsea. And
$398 million profit over the last few years.
And several Premier League titles. So it's not as if this is not, you know, this is not profit over progress. This is them managing to achieve both in their eyes. I think it is, you know, I'd call it a shame because I think for players like Callum Hudson-Odoi, it would be brilliant to see them progress at Chelsea. And I strongly suspect that if Hudson-Odoi and Pulisic were in opposite situations, then Chelsea might well be buying an 18-year-old from Borussia Dortmund that they thought was brilliant and allowing a 20-year-old who had come through their academy to go out on loan. I think that probably would happen. It's just how this model operates. But if they can then get $40 million for Callum Hudson-Odoi and therefore have paid a net £17 million or whatever for Pulisic and consider him a better player, it's hard to criticise the logic of that. I just don't particularly like the morality of it, I have to say. And I think the loan farm model will soon be ended by new loan regulations that are designed to stop exactly what they're doing. And I think that would be good for the game in general. I think it'd be good for those players who are in that farm. And I think it might well end up being good for Chelsea if it means they focus on just doing, you know, just the first team.
Mm. In the short term, they're not going to change, are they, Dom?
No. And as you've made mentioned the number there, $398 million. The only way to look at it, I think, and you have to recognise that there is a certain, quite a lot of frustration within that Chelsea academy, that their players that they are developing, that they feel are ready for the first team at Chelsea, are not getting opportunities at Chelsea. Understandably, that frustration is building up, and they see a Christian Pulisic coming in at a large fee. Regardless of whether he is a success or not, they feel that Callum Hudson-Odoi could do a similar job in the first team. But for whatever reason, whether it's a lack of faith in the current manager or because of the short-termism at senior level in terms of the coaching staff and management, they don't feel as if they can take a risk on a young player. That's just the reality of it. We've seen the treatment of Ruben Loftus-Cheek, very similar.
Mm. Should he actually force the issue? I know Sarri's saying
Loftus-Cheek, why should he? He's playing. He's actually playing now, I think, at the moment. Of Chelsea's performances over the last 6 to 8 weeks, Loftus-Cheek has been one of their better players. It will come to the stage where he has to play him in the Premier League, not least because Willian and Pedro are now injured. So there is an opportunity there for him to play. And I think there's no reason for Loftus-Cheek to force the issue at the moment. In the summer, it's a different because he'll have 2 years left on his contract, and then when does he, you know, when does he say to them, well, I need to be a first team regular now, or I'm going to do what Callum Hudson-Odoi is doing and agitate or make it known that I'm willing to leave. But my point was really that we shouldn't look at this Chelsea Academy as a problem, because are Chelsea's Academy producing young English players who are going into the professional game and excelling? Yes, they are. They're not necessarily doing it at Chelsea, but they are doing it in other English clubs, top flight clubs, Championship, lower level, but they're also potentially doing it to Bundesliga clubs as well. That talent will come through. If it's good enough, it will still reach the top. It just won't necessarily be with Chelsea. You know, in years to come, they may... It's not ludicrous that they've got an interest in, say, Nathan Ake, for example. You know, Dutch international, they sold, let go. They have a first option to buy him back. It wouldn't be a surprise if he came back to Chelsea in the future. Hudson-Odoi, I'm sure, if they've got anything about them, there'll be a clause in a contract if he leaves saying we'd have first option again. These people could come back to Chelsea potentially if they're good enough.
Mm, well, they're struggling for goals. They're struggling up front anyway. You've got Tammy Abraham, you know, it looks like with a loan and a £18 million move to Wolves. Surely, if they are going to be true to their academy, someone like Tammy Abraham deserves a chance, doesn't he?
I don't think he's good enough for Chelsea, to start for Chelsea. He might well be, given that they have a problem at the moment and he could be recalled from a loan until the summer as a, on a kind of emergency fill-in basis, perhaps. But I don't think he's the long-term answer for them, and I don't think Chelsea really consider him as to be the long-term answer for them.
Chelsea don't put crosses into the box.
No.
Tammy Abraham needs crosses into the box.
I think he is probably, and it's an incredibly damning thing to say when he's 21 years old, but he seems like the sort of player who will do a job for a bottom-half Premier League team, will score maybe 10 to 12 goals a season, but isn't quite at the level to lead Chelsea line. Because I think if he was at that level, he would already be involved in that setup, a la Loftus-Cheek, who is still there and is now starting to get games. But yeah, they are struggling to score goals. And this Eden Hazard false nine plan seems to work for Mauricio Sarri, but doesn't seem to work for every player in that system, particularly Eden Hazard, who 3 months ago was calling Olivier Giroud the best target man in world football as a pretty obvious message that he liked playing with him, has since seen Alvaro Morata drop further from the radar, and yet has almost become the Olivier Giroud plan himself in that he's now playing a centre-forward. And I think he'd probably prefer to play out, as long as he could play out on the left and be allowed to stay high up the pitch, I think that would always be Hazard's first choice. And he's never been shy of discussing the Real Madrid possibility, and if Chelsea want to keep him, it would be a good idea to keep him happy, I suspect.
Yeah, it looks, you know, pretty much like that Morata will leave. You know, Sevilla have been linked, haven't they? Also, interestingly, Hervin Lozano, the PSV Mexican winger, can you see that working?
Well, Chelsea do need wingers because, Pedro and Willian are in their 30s and contracts expire in 2020, I believe. Hudson-Odoi is obviously 2020 as well and likely to leave sooner rather than later. But whether those guys are able to play the style that Sarri wants them to, no one knows. Sarri is starting to make the same noises that Antonio Conte did in terms of transfer strategy. That's a club that's operating without a director of football. Marina Granovskaya is doing a lot of the negotiations. They've got a recruitment department that is quite extensive, but it's hard to know who sort of heads it at the moment. You know, is it Marina? Is it Scott McLachlan? Where do people go if they want to get a player to Chelsea? And I think that level of confusion is now being shown in actual transfer policy and strategy. And Sarri is starting to reflect that. All the teething trouble that he warned was going to happen at Chelsea when he came in, and we were hoodwinked in that first 3 months of the season when they were fantastic. Well, it's now being exposed. They're not right. And they'll have the occasional game, which will be fantastic, such as their second half performance against Manchester City. But they'll also have games where they look dysfunctional and they struggle. And Southampton was a case in point. Leicester City was a case in point. They failed to score in their previous two home games in the league. It's not a happy camp, and they're basically clawing for that top four place. And they need to hang on in there as long as they can.
Dom's point is it's bang on, because the one aspect watching Sarri's Napoli that you'd say is that it had his fingerprints all over that squad. But being able to do that when you haven't got control over transfers. You know, Sarri said, you know, they asked me about Pulisic a month ago and I told them my opinion, but I didn't know the move was going to happen. Now, it's very hard for a manager to have his fingerprints all over the team and all over the style if players are coming in where he doesn't necessarily know from one week to the next what's going to happen in that department. I'm sure he said that pointedly. We know he's done that in the past. He's not shy about, you know, saying what he thinks in those sort of situations. And as you said, on that was such a clear message of, well, hang on a minute. This guy's come in, but if this doesn't work out, it's not on me.
You know, to be entirely honest, under Mourinho, we'd pretty much written off Manchester United as a top four force, this season at least. It's all sweetness and light now. It's four matches, 14 goals, 40 million smiles. Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, is he making a case, or can he make a case to stay on after the summer?
Oh, he can, but let's just see what happens when they play someone good. I mean, I don't want to. That sounds terrible for the four teams that they've beaten already. But the reality is that was a nice time to take over, and he has made an impact. He's brought some positivity back. He has taken the shackles off. That team do look as if they're enjoying themselves again. We can't deny any of that, but. Okay, let's see how they do it at Spurs. Let's see whether they can perform with the same abandon and incision at Spurs as they have done, you know, in dismantling Newcastle, Cardiff, etc., etc., Huddersfield Town. I mean, these aren't you know, particularly impressive teams that they've been overcoming. It is refreshing to see the smiles back on the faces, and it's inevitable that now he's, you know, coming out saying, I don't want to leave. Well, carry on doing the best job you can and we'll see where we are in April, May time. But there are going to be some sterner tests ahead.
Do you sense the welcoming arm of Fergie on the shoulder?
I think it was for a man in Ed Woodward who has kind of been incompetent as standard, it was a very clever PR move. And it was a PR move that we didn't really see coming. You know, they announced that it would be someone with history at the club, but even at that point, no one really had the name of Ole Gunnar Solskjaer on the tip of the tongue. I actually, bizarrely, the more games he wins, particularly against lesser sides who they dispatch with more goals and more attacking prowess than they were before, I almost think he talked himself out of the job, because that's what he was brought in to do. He was brought in to give a temporary lift, to recharge the place, to revitalise the place, so that someone could come in with a truly, not just a blank canvas, but also with a squad that was ready to move forward rather than having to have this period of rehabilitation post Jose Mourinho. So I think he's doing exactly what was asked of him, but that doesn't mean he's necessarily going to get the full-time job, because when push comes to shove, his managerial aptitude has been questioned in the past far more than it's been proven. I think that's fair to say it. But Mulder and at Cardiff. He's doing exactly the right thing. And the difference in players, I think he has shown, is that he's got an eye for detail and an eye for looking, you know, an arm around the shoulder that maybe Mourinho lost in his latter days there. Someone like Marcus Rashford, who says, you know, he's telling me to pass the ball into the goal, and we have sessions where I pass the ball in, and then he does exactly that one or two games later. That's great. But that doesn't necessarily mean you're going to be Manchester United's long-term manager, I don't think.
Mm. Who realistically has got a chance of becoming that manager? You know, Marco Rose from Red Bull Salzburg's been mentioned. You're needing to get someone of huge stature, you know, by definition, for a job like that.
Yeah, we mentioned Pochettino earlier. I'd be amazed if they didn't target him. They should be going for somebody who is a long-term appointment. I mean, we're not talking Fergie length of time, but just, you know, more than two and a half years would be good. It was because it's still a rebuilding job. As much as they spent loads of money under Mourinho, they're still playing a huge game of catch-up with City, with Liverpool, with Spurs. The danger is they're even falling behind. They could, this season, have fallen behind, say, an Arsenal in terms of that game to catch up. But, you know, maybe Solskjaer will lift them to and remind the players of how good they actually are, they've got.
Yeah, this might offend a few sensibilities, but do they need to find their Klopp?
Well, yeah, there are a few clubs out there that need to find their Klopp. But, yeah, I mean, that would... Yes, you're right. That sort of ilk. We're talking somebody who can... Yeah, who has that revitalising effect on the players who are there, but also is looking long-term, will be prepared to make ruthless decisions on who will take the club forward and who will take his team forward, and has a long-term vision as to what they want to be. But we could have said that about Manchester United in the latter years of Fergie's tenure, or the, you know, certainly when Moyes and Van Gaal were there.
I mean, Solskjaer's doing the kind of Klopp-light stuff of the saying the right things... Yeah. You know, looking the right way, smiling in the right places. It's whether he's got that, you know, Klopp's grinning demeanour actually covers a fairly, you know,
hard
very
man.
Entrenched, yeah, and an entrenched coaching and tactical system that, you know, is pretty all-encompassing. It goes a lot beyond smiles and giggles and arms by the shoulder. The question is whether Solskjaer's got that depth, and I don't believe he has, actually. That's just how it is. But, yeah, if they can find a manager who can... bring everyone together and put smiles on faces and have that tactical depth, then you've got your Klopp. Whether or not... I honestly don't necessarily believe that's anyone but Pochettino. If they fail to attract him, then I think there's a... You know, there's not many names there. Zinedine Zidane is such a leap in the other direction and such a short-termist appointment that I don't see that working. And after that, you know, you say like names like Marco Rosa, who just... I mean, that sounds like they are looking around for a new Klopp, doesn't it? You know, they're looking in Germany. He's played for Mainz, played under Klopp, played under Tuchel before. Just sounds like it's exactly what they're doing.
I mean, you can't have a short-term solution at that United. That squad is made up from by players who've joined under different managers. I mean, throughout, it's a mishmash of a squad of different styles that the manager at the time has wanted to pursue. It needs someone to come in and work out where they want to be long-term and make ruthless decisions, you know, along those lines. And Zidane wouldn't work in that scenario, would it?
Are Arsenal at that point in time now? Emery's had time to bed in. He's seen, you know, frankly, what is a disaster area of defence exposed. Mm. You've got the arm wrestle over Mesut Ozil. Very interesting that the agent came out, which is usually a surefire sign that something's going wrong somewhere. What does he need to do to impose himself on that club?
I think he's probably got one of the most difficult jobs in the Premier League because we talk about Manchester United playing catch-up. Arsenal are doing that even more. Mm-hmm. They were allowed to decline even further under Arsene Wenger than Manchester United were under Jose Mourinho. And they don't have the budgets to spend as quickly or spend as thoroughly or... as extravagantly as Manchester United or Liverpool or Manchester City or Chelsea and Tottenham have an infinitely better first team and arguably a deeper squad, even despite how thin it is. So, yeah, I think he has a huge, huge task on his plate because I think not just supporters, but kind of we in general in the media are used to a strong Arsenal and therefore we're used to them being a team that will want to fight for the title. And I think they're such a long way away from that now. It's going to take two or three transfer windows. And the reality is that managers don't get two or three transfer windows pressure-free anymore or responsibility-free. So we're going to have to see improvements in... I mean, their defence is bottom half. That back four is bottom half of the Premier League in terms of standard. And, yeah, it's going to have to change quickly. But I don't think he can do that in the transfer market quickly enough to cause a rapid improvement.
Yeah. Let's look then, when you mentioned bottom half, at the relegation situation. You know, there's a big weekend coming up, and a couple of very key fixtures. Also, you've got Newcastle at Chelsea in the BT Sport game. Now, it's the new year, so what have we got? It's the fans have got an open letter to Ashley, please give us some signings. You've got Benitez being... let's say, evasive about his future and his commitment. Are Newcastle in danger of going down?
I don't think they are. Let's say that wrong. I don't think they will go down. They are in danger at the moment because they're hovering just above the relegation places. But I think Benitez is still the key to them staying up. and his ability to organise. It's great having a goal scorer, obviously, and that takes you well clear. But the club's down there, even up to 14th place. And then there's a gap between Palace and Brighton, I think, at the moment. All those teams are down there for a reason, because they lack a goal scorer, largely. But the ones that can organise well steer clear. Palace have had 8 clean sheets this season in the Premier League. They're just 3-4 points clear of the scrap, Newcastle being at the top of that one. Newcastle have that capability as well. They can knuckle down in the key fixtures, not necessarily against the best teams, but against the sort of lower mid-table and the teams down the foot, and they can grind out 1-0 wins, 0-0 draws, you know, and just keep themselves above the cutoff in that respect. He's not going to get the massive transfer funds that he hoped he would. Newcastle as a club are no further down the line now than they were 2 months ago, 3 months ago, 15 months ago, 18 months ago. The fans will want the owner out. The manager, let's face it, he wants the owner out as well. The owner himself hasn't had an offer that he's prepared to go with. That state of limbo is unsettling, and it will eventually see Benitez leave Tyneside. I mean, that will happen because his ambitions will not be satisfied by just keeping Newcastle in the division. But this season, that's what he'll do. He'll keep them up.
Mm. Huddersfield, 8 successive defeats. They're at Cardiff. Is it right to assume if they lose that one, they're done for?
Yeah, I think it probably is. I think they might be done for now, actually. They're 6 of their last 8 games have been against the teams kind of, well, within that bottom 8 in the Premier League, and they've lost every single one. They're painfully desperate for a goal scorer. At home, they've created chances, and Aaron Moy has been excellent in part, but there's just nobody to finish the chances. Joe Lolly's their second top league goal scorer at home in 2018, and he joined Forest in January. So, you know, I think Steve Mooney has got 2 and Alex Pritchard's got 2, and that's it. They are absolutely desperate for goals. And the problem is that they are resolute defensively, and Wagner is capable of setting up a side defensively, and I think he will flourish at a higher level, but the defence is just not quite good enough individually to counteract the painful lack of goals. And yeah, I think they probably are done. It should be said that they probably have got should have the lowest ambitions of any Premier League team. You know, last season was the miracle. This is the reality. So I hope it doesn't impact on Wagner's reputation.
Are we seeing another Warnock miracle?
Well, possibly. I mean, I think we can write off the games against the top 5 or 6, which clearly is what he's done as well. But when you look at some of the performances his team have put in, limited players as well. We're not talking like proper stellar names. Some of the defensive displays, Palace and Leicester City over Christmas, so admirable, absolutely fantastic, and properly got stuck in. They've got dashes of quality within the side, but only dashes. I mean, Højlund might be capable of the occasional, you know, great goal like he scored against Wolves earlier in the season. Cameron Asser, the midfielder, wonderful finish at Leicester, but he was excellent at Selhurst Park a few days previously to that. He was their threat. And you chuck in the sort of commitment of a Sol Bamba, Mango, who's just been fantastic as well the last few games, Steve Morrison, who just never gives up, and the goalkeeper is a blooming revelation. I mean, Fulham must be looking at him and wondering how they let that one go, through the net, because he's been superb. And quite often when you get a team that comes up who are going to be punching above the weight, their goalkeeper does tend to stand out because he's the busiest keeper in the division. David Marshall did it at Cardiff last time. Etheridge has been something else. I mean, he'll stay in the Premier League whatever happens to Cardiff City this season.
Fulham at Burnley. Let's talk about goalkeepers, shall we? Tom Heaton has come in. Right decision at the right time?
Yeah, and a pretty brave decision from Sean Dyche. You could argue that he'd cycled through all of his other options, and I think he actually said that himself. He said, we've tried everything else, and there comes a point where you have to change your goalkeeper. And And Tom Heaton has kept two clean sheets on the bounce, I think. So he's...
They conceded one at Huddersfield. Play well.
But, yeah, I mean, the thing with Burnley is that for the first half of the season, they conceded shots at a rate like we've never seen before in the Premier League. They were abject. But we know they can do it. We know that basically these set of defenders have... and goalkeeper have done this before.
They forgot how to play like Burnley.
Yeah, they did. They Dyche said at the start of the season, we're in a really difficult position because people want more and more of us. But if we, the moment we try and change the way we play, we effectively revert back to promoted team again because we're doing something completely new. And what we did got us promoted. So he's in a very difficult position without further investment to do anything more than that. And yeah, I think they will be fine because they will kind of revert back to what they know.
Just want to almost go back to where we started. A couple of questions from the listeners and the viewers. Stefan Adams, who do you think is the most underrated player in the Premier League? I think Son at Spurs, but Bernardo Silva goes under the radar, in my opinion.
Is it possible to be underrated if you play for Tottenham Hotspur or Manchester City? I don't know. I mean, both of those players are fantastic. And we've mentioned Bernardo Silva, who was a man possessed against Liverpool. Son went from a player who misses a load of chances to a player who takes a load of chances almost overnight. Both fantastic players. But I wouldn't say that either of them are underrated. I think if you're talking about an underrated player, just pluck one out of the ether. that's... Yeah. I mean, you're basically asking for a name that no one's talking about.
I'd say Aaron
Moyer at Huddersfield.
Moyer's great.
They're missing him, and they're going to miss him for a long period, and that could be.
I think the key. Brighton centre backs been absolutely excellent. I know, Shane Duffy does play for Ireland and did receive an England call up. But yeah, I think they've been probably two of the best centre backs.
Great shout that, because everybody focuses on Dunk. That sort of homegrown talent who's done well, but Duffy gets sent off against Palace. The next three games they get exposed defensively very, very badly, comes back in immediately, pick up results again, and that does tell you. I mean, it's about combinations. You're right, centre half. I have to say Aaron Wan-Bissaka though, don't I? I mean, that's like a rule. Aaron Wan-Bissaka is an absolute revelation at right back. He was playing as a winger 14 months ago and hadn't played a Premier League game this time last year.
All right. Well, time's run away with us. Just a final question. Who's going to win the league, Premier League?
I'm going to let Don say one. I'm going to say that's how it's going to go.
I said Manchester City all season and I'll stick with them.
Liverpool then.
Good man. Well, I'll call it a draw. Liverpool win the Premier League, City win the Champions League. Honours even? Thanks for joining us here on the Football Writers Podcast.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Hi. This is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.